Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, I have got on Bonnie Snyder, who is the Director of High School Outreach at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, aka FIRE. She's also the author of the new book, Undoctrinate: How Politicized Classrooms Harm Kids and Ruin Our Schools and What We Can Do About It. So that is a mouthful of a book right there. But Bonnie, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm all good. We actually wanted to record this a little bit earlier. I was having some internet issues, but I think I've sorted it out now. So hopefully we'll have a nice, smooth podcast. So I've done a brief intro there, Bonnie, but tell the people a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I've been working at FIRE for 5 years. FIRE is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and we defend constitutional rights on campus. We're nonpartisan. Most of our employees are lawyers. I am not a lawyer. I'm an educator for the most part, and I've been a college professor. I've been a high school teacher. I've been a high school counselor, and I've been a mom with kids in school, both mostly public, a little bit of private school as well. And, you know, this topic of politicizing education has been important to me for a while.
Awesome. And what was it that got you involved with FIRE to begin with?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think that I have been aware of the issues that FIRE deals with ever since graduate school. I actually went to, believe it or not, a lot of the issues that we're hearing about came out of humanities departments. You would think they would come out of, you know, political science departments or, you know, maybe even economics departments. But a lot of it came out of humanities, which is where I was studying. So I feel like I was sort of there at the beginning when these ideas sort of were coming into the academy. I actually dropped out of an English PhD program over it. Back then, it was sort of called, it was called critical theory at the time. Before that, it was just called theory, literary theory. And then it became critical theory, or at least, you know, my introduction, it was critical feminist theory at the time. And I just did not find value in it. I felt that it was a waste of my time, a waste of my energy. I looked at the literature that people were writing, and I said to myself, not only do I not want to read this, I can't imagine ever producing any of this, you know, scholarly types of articles. So I just left it behind and went on with my life. And I was, you know, I had hoped to become a Shakespearean, you know, professor of Shakespeare. And I recognized it then when my kids were being exposed to it, because in the intervening years, it had trickled down to K-12 through the academy.
Mm. So that first notion of critical theory, which you encountered decades ago, what did that look like? What was it that they were teaching?
Well, it was more like what they weren't teaching. I mean, it was ridiculous at the time. It was also called deconstruction, which I just nicknamed it destruction, because it was just about tearing apart all of these great works of literature that I really wanted to study and I really wanted to learn. And I remember arguing, I wasn't arguing, but asking one of my professors to try to convince me to stay. And he said to me, you know, we're deconstructing the canon. And I said, well, that's really interesting for you because you got to study the canon and you already know it. But for me, for a student who's arriving, I'd like to learn it first before I deconstruct it. And I really felt like they were doing things that were interesting to themselves instead of what was appropriate for the students. So, you know, it was like they were just sort of indulging their own interests. But it reached the point back then, this would have been in the 90s, that they actually were arguing that, you know, every literary work is as good as any other literary work. It's this sort of great leveling. And it reached the absurd level where they would say that reading a restaurant menu is the equivalent of reading Tolstoy or, you know, reading Shakespeare. It was that ridiculous.
Yeah. I'm not the first person to say it, but they often say that there are ideas that are so stupid that only an academic could possibly believe them. And that absolutely sounds like one. It's also funny because it undermines their own profession, doesn't it? I mean, if everything is the same as everything, then what's the point of even going to university? What's the point of even studying if everything is just equivalent and none of it matters? It seems like a very self-defeating point.
Well, and I think that we're finding out that it is because enrollments are down in college and specifically among males. A lot of colleges are like 60, 40, 65, 35 female dominated now. And so people are staying away. And they have undermined themselves. I mean, their credibility and you know, the value of a college degree, if why invest in it if the, you know, this piece of paper, the only thing that it represents is the value that people, you know, infer from it. And if you undermine it, then clearly. And I mean, now, you know, we were just discussing how a person could go out and get a job making six figures, I think, driving a truck right now. So, why put yourself through that, especially if it, you know, I was willing to make a sacrifice because I really believed in the value of it. But if they were undermined, you know, like, yeah, the humanities doesn't pay all that well, but at least you get the enrichment of reading these wonderful, great works that informs your life. And it, you know, hopefully ennobles you and fulfills you and gives you all of these great insights. But if you're just going to hand me a restaurant menu, you know, this is not worth my time. There was also a lot of just rejecting books because of who'd written them. You know, like you're supposed to not look at the book, and what the book has to tell you. But repeatedly, there was a particular student, female student, in every class who would just denounce every book that was written by a white man. And, you know, she would point out, well, this was written by a white man. Like, of course, we all know that. Everyone knew that before this already started. Yeah. And so like, I just, that's another, this identity politics game where you're supposed to judge something, the value of something by who did it. And, you know, I make the point in the book that, you know, there are other methods of judging the value of something or figuring something out. It's like, just because somebody has a certain identity doesn't make them right or doesn't make them wrong. It's like, you know, the vaccine that we came up with for the COVID virus, like, I don't care who made it. What I care is that they followed a rigorous process and that they tested it and cross-tested it to try to disprove it until they found the best possible solution. And ultimately, it doesn't matter if it was a man or a woman or what race they were or even how old they were. What matters is the process and even a child, it's like that old fable of the emperor's new clothes. Truth can come from any source. Even a white man can be right sometimes.
I mean, a couple of them have been right a couple of times. Yeah. I mean, if we were to get rid of everything that a white man's ever created, then I don't think many people would want to live in that world in reality, if they actually think about it. But one thing that's really interesting is that you're talking about this back in the 90s. So I think that in the time we live in now, in 2020, 2021, a lot of people are for the first time hearing some of these concepts. A lot of people up until a year or two ago perhaps had never heard of critical theory, let alone critical race theory. They'd never heard of perhaps some of the gender ideology, postmodernism, a lot of these other ideas and as Gad Saad calls them, idea pathogens, but you encountered all of this stuff decades ago. So how have you seen that evolution happen?
Well, I think that it's spread throughout academia. I think that academia has been drifting to the left through the intervening years. I think that some of the other ways in which this has spread includes, it's happened slowly and also suddenly. And I would say when I encountered it, I now understand was not the first. That was not when it was introduced to academia. A lot of people would trace it back probably to the 1930s. How have I seen it come into K-12? I mean, slowly and then very suddenly is how I've seen it happen in K-12. I think that, it's come in many guises. It has come, there's been a lot of arguing about diversifying the curriculum. And I do think we have been diversifying the curriculum over a number of decades. But what has suddenly happened this past school year is, I think, radicalizing the curriculum under the guise of diversifying the curriculum. So I think that there's a lot of deceptive language is used, a lot of cloaking is used to import these ideas. And I think that, what is presented to families and parents is often, not what's actually behind the curtain. So I think there's a lot of deception that has taken place, and parents are figuring this out.
I hear that. What do you think is the goal with all of this?
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. I mean, If I want to go back, I think there's a lot of Marxist ideology embedded in what's happening, and I think that there are Marxist aims. I think that there are very strong political aims, and I think that kids are a vehicle. Certainly, they're impressionable. Their faculties are not fully developed, and I think that I don't want to overly politicize our discussion, but I do think that critical theories are based in neo-Marxism, if you look closely. And, it is a means of, and I think that, I think that critical race theory, which is the thing that people are yelling about the most right now, although this problem has many forms, I think it is an argument for implementing Marxist solutions. I think that, So I just wish that I'm not opposed to discussing Marxism in school. I think it's an important topic. I think it's worth discussing. I just want it to be transparent about what we're talking about. That's a criticism that I have of critical theory. I mean, critical theory is itself a criticism, but a big problem with it is that it will not withstand, it will not stand for criticism of itself. And it's a disagreement. It's saying that this narrative, that, the dominant narrative, we have a disagreement with it. And, in America with free speech, one of the things we want in school is to allow kids to disagree, to allow anyone in our culture to speak up and say, I don't think so. And here's why, because we might learn something from that. But it's the way in which it's being implemented, in that this is the answer. We know that it is, and do not question it or else you are going to be condemned. And that's a very fearful thing, position for a child to be put in, or anyone. A lot of people are afraid to speak up because of the consequences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely something that's, there's a big chill that's been going on for a long period of time, and it's getting worse and worse, and it's infecting every segment of Western society, for sure. For someone who's not really familiar with some of the terminology, can you give a little primer on what critical theory is to someone who's not very familiar with it?
Oh, gosh, critical theory. Let me think. I mean, in terms of critical theory and critical race theory is basically saying that the narrative that we've been presented with isn't true for everyone. And in terms of critical race theory, they're essentially arguing that if you look at American history through the lens of race, you will see that there are certain systems that have been built into our organizations that continue to cause problems today. And you know, so it, you could look at our system of justice, for example, and then you could do the same thing with feminist theory and say, you know, that there are certain systems that cause women to experience disadvantages. And you can, you know, measure these, and that you could, you know, you could do a critical feminist reading of Shakespeare. You could do a critically racialized reading of, you know, Shakespeare, or an interpretation of statistics. So it's a lens. It's a way of looking at the world. It's one way of looking at the world. But there's sort of some teachers, some activist-minded teachers, are presenting it as the way to look at everything in the world all the time. And I think that students need to be given multiple perspectives and to be able to sort of interrogate that position as well. But it's being presented in a heavy-handed, sort of coercive way. We call it thought reform at FIRE, where it's like, you know, it's one thing to present a child with like, oh, have you thought about this? Have you considered that? Have you looked at it from this perspective? But it's another thing to imply that you need to look at it from this perspective. Don't dare look at it from any other perspective. And if you do, we're going to humiliate you. That's happening to some kids. Kids are being shamed. Kids are being labeled according to their skin color sometimes in classes, and being told that their existence is inherently problematic. And, you know, it gets up against, and there are lawsuits now, civil rights lawsuits, because a child who's required by law to go to school and then is sort of stigmatized or separated and targeted because of their skin color. I mean, this is something that we've learned not to do, but now we're deciding, well, if the right people do it, it's okay. Well, it's going to court.
Can you explain some of the things that you've encountered personally as a mother? What are some of the things that have your children been subject to some of this? Can you give a couple examples of things that you yourself have encountered, or perhaps your children or other people's children that you know have had to deal with in this regard? Because I think a lot of people don't see how far it's gone and just how insidious it all is.
Yeah, I mean, I've been keeping lists for a couple of years now, and I did pull my daughter out of a private school over some of the nonsense that was going on there. I'm actually embarrassed to describe some of the stories that went on in the school. But one, I'll give you one example that went on in the school. I mean, just one example is that on Columbus Day, my daughter went to school and her teacher told her that Christopher Columbus is a giant D-bag. She, you know, and I just thought, you know, so I went in and I said, you know, okay, first of all, language. And second of all, you know, would you say on St. Patrick's Day that the same thing about St. Patrick? And, you know, but what really got to me was that she denied that it had happened. And a lot of people are having this experience. So there's the whole deceit are a part of it that's happening. My daughter was also given in school the Communist Manifesto to read, which I don't object to. It's an important book. Everyone should read and understand it. But then she was sat around a table and asked to compare capitalism to communism. And the class, having been given one book to read, the Communist Manifesto, and the class decided that communism is a better system than capitalism. And again, when I went in and I said, what kind of learning exercise is this? They denied that it even happened. I knew perfectly well that it had. And, you know, you can have a bad lesson and teachers can learn. But when you lie about it, which is what they did, now you're dealing with bad people. And I was like, that I can't fix that. Like, if you are deceitful people, then just like morally, you are not people I want my child around. So that was the crux of what went wrong at that school. But in terms, I mean, I have so many of these stories, Zuby, that
can I ask, how old is your daughter? What sort of age are we talking about here?
Oh, my kids are in their 20s now. So this was 10 years ago.
This was 10 years ago. Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So this is when they were about 10?
No, they're 25. So,
oh,
15.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Teenagers. Okay.
And here's another thing that was going on. They had this club called the Diversity Club, and it was student run, and they would put the kids in the auditorium, and it's kind of a small school, and they would stand in a circle, and then they would ask you, or they would sit, you would be sitting in a circle, and they would put you on the spot and say, if you support this cause, stand up in front of everyone. And back then it was causes like, it changed all the time, but the one I remember was Occupy Wall Street. Do you support Occupy Wall Street or not? But the next week it would be something else. So you had to decide whether publicly you were going to either stand or sit. And even if you were for it, you had to decide if you wanted to, everyone to know that you're for it. And if you sit, you know that everyone, and they would follow you. Like the teachers sat there, they thought this was fine. And then anyone who didn't stand for the right causes, they would come to you in the hallways and you would be corrected. So there was intense peer pressure. It was like, you know, Lord of the Flies-ish kind of bullying types of behavior. That was 10 years ago. So, and yeah, now we have students, we hear from students at FIRE who, you know, I self-censor all the time. It's like, my teacher doesn't care what I think. She doesn't want to hear what I think. She wants to hear what she thinks. And now I have a choice. Do I say, am I honest in class, or do I have to play a role? But in terms of some of these whoppers, I've got them divided into five categories. I have so many. One of the ones that caught a lot of attention was the Antifa teacher out in California, I believe, who was caught on camera saying that I have 180 days to turn these kids into radicals. He was giving them extra credit to go to, I guess, Antifa rallies, you know, which is misusing his power as a teacher to award, you know, grades, credit, right? That goes towards your grade in order to get you to participate in his pet causes. That's a real moral problem. Right now, we are seeing, it depends what week it is, where my focus is, but we're hearing a lot of lurid stories. I heard at a conference I was at, 6-year-olds being asked, are you bisexual? That doesn't seem like kindergarten as I remember it. Megyn Kelly, the broadcaster, I guess she's a podcaster now, said that her son was asked in third grade, are you still a boy? Every week, are you still a boy? Because when you are a teenager, there are drugs you can take, and then you can have your genitals removed if you don't want to be a boy anymore. Does that sound like third grade? First graders being taught how to masturbate. My joke is, I was taught how to hold a pencil correctly in first grade, but these kids are being taught really different things. I have a lot of I have examples of deception, not just my own. Oh, but one of my favorite stories is, favorite story. My first year at FIRE 5 years ago, a student contacted us because the school was doing a walkout. And there were a couple of these walkouts. This one happened to be for after the Parkland shootings, and it was for gun control. And it was, my understanding was students were supposed to walk out, you know, like they were striking school because it's not safe and they were going to teach the school a lesson. But this school decided that the whole school was going to walk out, teachers, administrators included. They're just not going to have school. They're just walking out. And this student said, but I don't agree with this cause. I don't want to support this cause. This isn't my view. And he said, can't I just go to school this day? This is public school. And they said, oh, well, no, actually you can't, because there won't be anyone in the school to supervise you. And they said, well, we're just going to go walk around the track in a circle anyway, which seems like a pretty pointless exercise, but that's a side point. So their solution was, how about if you, we have an idea, you'll just stand in the middle of the track and we'll just walk around you in a circle. Right. What adolescent want, and no one thought this was a bad idea. So that's just an example of the sort of warped thinking that we're going to put a teenager in the middle of the track and we're going to walk around you and you're the sole, you know, dissenter. You are the one weirdo in our class who won't participate. Just common sense.
Yeah, that's crazy. Also, again, like I said, I'm surprised by, I knew that this stuff has been going on for a while, but I didn't know that it has been that bad for that long. Right. Something else I've also noticed, and I mean, this might be my own myopia and bias to some extent because I don't have the same knowledge of everywhere else, but it seems to me from what I know that a lot of this stuff is relatively unique to the Western world. This doesn't seem to be something that's necessarily happening globally. It seems to be a big problem in places like Canada, particularly the Anglosphere, Canada, USA, UK, perhaps Australia, New Zealand, maybe some parts of Western Europe, but it's not really a global thing. It seems to be something that is specifically happening in the modern Western world. Number one, is that something that you've noticed or you think is correct, or is it wider than that? And number two, if so, why do you think that is?
Yeah, I think that my observation is that it seems to be worse in affluent areas in the United States. And I guess in the world, we are among the affluent countries. So it seems to be some sort of self-loathing maybe, or guilt-riddenness, and a way of, I'm all for, examining ourselves and self-reproach, but I also believe in balance. And I think that I think there's bad things and there are good things about the United States. And I think that, I just think it's general common sense in terms, the president of FIRE has talked a lot about mental health and young people, and he wrote the book, The Coddling of the American Mind. And, I just think in terms of preventing kids from the anxiety and depression rates that are skyrocketing now, let's give them more optimism than pessimism. I think that that's just what young people need, because they have so much of their lives ahead of them. And this is just so dispiriting and discouraging. And I hear from a lot of minority parents too, who are like, please don't tell my kids that they are hopelessly oppressed and the victims of a society that will never treat them fairly. This is not messaging that is going to be useful to them in their lives. I did, however, hear from, I was interviewed by a Dutch newspaper, and they said that they are seeing it there, which is still the Western world, if not the Anglosphere, but they see it as being imported from the U.S.
Yeah, it's interesting. The USA is a huge exporter of a lot of great things and a lot of bad things.
Yeah.
I noticed the same in the UK, right? I mean, because the USA has a very different history to the UK. So there are certain things and issues that don't really, that apply to the USA to some degree and have more truth in them. But then if you try to take that template and stick it on another country, it just doesn't work. I mean, to give a fantastic example, I mean, last year, in the middle of last year, you had the whole BLM summer thing. You know, there was the death of George Floyd, and you started out in Minnesota, and then in lots of major U.S. cities and even some smaller cities, you started having all these protests and some riots. And then, I mean, there were BLM protests going on after that in different cities in the UK and in random countries in Europe that don't even have black people in them, and all over. And I mean, that issue, even if you're talking about, say, like police violence or police brutality or black people or people in general being killed by police in dubious circumstances, like that's not a British thing. Like that's not a UK issue in any way, shape, or form. I mean, the narrative is framed in a certain dishonest way often in the USA even, but at least there's numbers there where it's like, okay, this is a thing. I think in the UK last year, I want to say the police killed something like two unarmed people in total. It might have even been two people in total. It's not a thing though. it's not an issue here, right?
And
it's
yet,
not.
Before every Premier League soccer game now, they take a knee.
There you go. Yeah. Another brilliant example, right? That's something that, again, it was started out in the USA. Regardless of how someone feels about it, it's like, okay, that's like a very American issue. Also, just in terms of demographics, I mean, the black population in the US is about 13% of the population. In the UK, it's like two. I mean, the USA is a far more diverse country in every meaning of that word than the UK is. But people sort of piggyback onto these things, and people want to be a part of it and get involved in all this. And it's very, I think there's a lot of cool things that could be imported from the USA. But I think.
But not our neuroses,
Yeah. not their racialization and this obsession over weird stuff, which ultimately is divisive. And like you said, I think it's Teaching this stuff to people and drilling it into their heads, it doesn't do any good for anyone, right? I'm so grateful. I'm very, very grateful that my parents, my teachers, people around me when I was growing up never ingrained this sort of victim mentality in my head, or this notion that, because I'm black, my life is going to be super hard, or that white people are just sort of inherently bad or somehow against me or whatever it is. I mean, it's not good for black people. It's not good for white people. It's not good for people of any race, any ethnicity. All it does is creates fear and anxiety and potential hostility and grounds for conflict. And it creates this us versus them mentality, which yep. is something I'm really not a fan of. And as we all know throughout history, when you do that, it's crazy. My mind has so many thoughts on it. I mean, in the USA of all countries, people know not to play that game. I mean, it's not that long ago that, you know, it was worked out. You know what? Maybe judging people based on the color of their skin and treating them differently or demonizing, right. that's not a good idea. Let's move past that. And it seems like it got past that. And I want to say that in the 90s and 2000s, it kind of mostly all went away. Like, it was really on life support. And right. now in the past few years, you have people there really, really trying to bring it back to life. You have people who are thriving. I mean, racism is almost an industry which people are profiting off of, right? At least race hustling, let me say, right? You know,
especially
stirring all these pots.
In academia, very much so. I mean, it is a huge business. I mean, billions have been spent on this DEI industry. You know, and in the schools, these consultants, I have a couple pet peeves. And one is that, you know, teachers are supposed to be licensed by the state. And you're licensed because you're in a position to do harm. You're dealing with vulnerable people, in this case, children, other people's children. You know, we have to be fingerprinted now to be around children. And yet they let these consultants just come in the side door, and it's really unregulated industry. And they're doing some really weird stuff. They are just like implementing these therapeutic techniques that are unproven, that, you know, the best example I know of is that Boston Public Schools hired these group of consultants who had to be fired. And there's this huge, you know, or rather large scandal involving what they're calling unlicensed therapy. Like, I was trained as a guidance counselor, and I know enough to know that I don't know enough to do the things that they're attempting to do.
Okay. What were they doing?
Oh, well, they were like taking kids, like, just here's a tip. If anybody wants to take your kid away on like some weird weekend with the, you know, the creepy youth counselor, don't sign that permission slip. And like one of the things I saw was like, get down on a mat and wrestle with each other, and that will relieve you of your racial tension or something. And I'll watch.
What?
Yeah, right. Look it up. Look up Boston Globe, Boston Public Schools unlicensed therapy. Like, the students are traumatized. They're like, something bad happened to me, and I don't want to talk.
Gosh.
Just weird stuff. And like these teachers seem to think that they are therapists now. You're not. You're not a therapist. It's like, if you're an English teacher, there's a very specific, you know, there are learning standards for your grade, for your state, that you're supposed to cover. And it probably doesn't talk about the latest, you know, whatever's happening in the news. Like, talking about current events is always risky, because, you know, there's a saying that hindsight is 20/20, right? And so if that's true, that means your present sight is probably less than perfect vision. And so there's a reason why teachers don't just go in there and be like, let me tell you what I think about, you know, the upcoming election. Let me tell you what I think about what's going on right now. Because first of all, you've got kids from all sorts of backgrounds in that classroom. And second of all, you know, I give advice to teachers too. And I'm like, look, if you have to be even-handed. There have been lawsuits where teachers have lost their jobs and, you know, been fired because of their lack of even-handedness. And also, you are supposed to avoid inflammatory material. Inflammatory material, it means it's going to like heat up. It's going to blow up. It's going to cause a fire by way I mean, like people are going to get there and you're not going to get through your lesson for the day. And so I tell them, you know, look, if it is currently trending hotly on Twitter or in the op-ed pages of your local newspaper, it's probably not the best lesson because nothing's going to get accomplished. People are just going to get upset. You're going to have an argument and little will be learned, right? You're just going to, people are just going to, like, yeah, kids will be interested in it, probably for all the wrong reasons. It's not that, that's not to say you should never talk about what's happening, but it has, it's a school. It has to be covered academically. Like, you're not hired to just sit there and shoot your mouth off about your personal opinions. Nobody should pay for that. That's not what, what teachers are there to do.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think is the, what do you think is the way forward on this? I see, I've spoken to, and I see a lot of different opinions on this. I see people who think that the public school system can be reformed. I see people who just think, no, we need to abolish it. We need to pull all the children out of these schools. We need to homeschool or set up co-ops or private schools or whatever it is. What do you think is the way forward?
Well, it kind of depends when you ask me if I'm feeling optimistic or pessimistic. I'm kind of right in the middle. I'm kind of like coming up from pessimism, but I'm not too optimistic yet. I would not advise someone not to investigate homeschooling right now or to consider investigating in it. I think, you know, we've been going to homeschooling conventions with FIRE to promote our curriculum. We have curriculum materials. I guess that's one thing I would advise is like, look at our curriculum materials about your rights and about free speech. They're nonpartisan. They're aligned with learning standards. But I do think I think personally that the power of the unions and that the power of credentialing and the power of the ed schools, that's a whole other problem here. The imbalance in the professors at the ed schools, I think their power
When you say ed schools, what does that mean? I'm not familiar with the term.
Yeah, so to become a licensed educator in a state, you have to earn a degree. And usually that means you go to an education school.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep, and the ed schools are among the most imbalanced in the whole academy in higher ed. And like, I would say that there is virtually no intellectual diversity left. It, you know, it runs the gamut from, you know, Y to Z in terms of the spectrum of thought that now exists there. So, you know, how do we fix that? This problem has been decades in the making. It will not be solved overnight. If you're worried, I mean, I pulled my kid out of a school and we ended up doing cyber schooling and it was much, much better. So I think that the you know, there's a big movement to have the money follow the child. So if you're spending $10,000 a year on this kid's on each kid's education, why do they have to have that money spent at the local public school? Why can't they take it? I understand that, you know, that enrollments at religious schools are skyrocketing, but even some of those are have social justice mindsets. So in the private schools, you can't buy your way out of this in most cases. In my understanding from what I'm hearing is that it is worse in most private schools than even in the public schools. At least the public schools have layers of oversight, like the school board, and you're seeing the explosive action going on at school boards, but private schools don't even have that.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, there seems to be in the private schools, I'm picking up that there's resentment. I mean, you've got very affluent parents at many of these, and it seems like there might be some resentment among the staff for this parents, and they perhaps take it out on the students with some of this ideology. You know, the neo-Marxism involves class envy, right? And resentment, stoking resentments. And I think these are, you know, traits that humans have. And we used to try to, you know, cultivate our better nature. But I think right now we're indulging those very unpleasant aspects of human tendencies with these ideologies.
Absolutely. I've seen some debate recently, again, in the USA about putting cameras in schools. Do you think that there should be cameras or that each of these classes should be recorded so that parents can actually see what is going on? Because it seems that with the advent of remote learning, due to the pandemic situation and the lockdowns, it seems like a lot of parents suddenly realized, by snooping in on their remote learning sessions, they raised some eyebrows and some questions about what their kids were actually learning. So do you think that's a good idea? I hear some people think it's some kind of invasion of privacy, or it might make people act weird. But other people have said, hey, you know, if cops should have body cameras that are kept on, then absolutely teachers should, especially if they're there with all these children. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that there are pros and cons with it, but ultimately there already are cameras in every classroom because every kid in there has a cell phone, and a lot of these incidents have been brought to light because kids are filming their teachers. And so teachers, be advised, you are likely on camera even if you don't know it, because these, and just the fact that kids have enough wherewithal to film their teacher. Did you ever have a teacher who behaved so badly that you felt like you should report them or would film them because their behavior was that inappropriate?
In hindsight, yes, Okay. Absolutely. In hindsight, absolutely. I mean, I went to boarding school and there was some stuff that went on there, which like, to be honest, as a kid, some of it I was like, this is a little bit weird. But as an adult, I'm like, man, that was screwed up.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, based on that, I'm guessing you think there should be cameras in classrooms.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't thought about it that deeply. I don't think the argument against it is particularly strong. I mean, right. If I were a teacher, I don't think I'd have any issue being right. filmed or being recorded, because. Right. I think the police officer comparison is actually decently fair. It's like, well, you know, if you're doing your job properly, there's nothing to be concerned about. In fact, it could also protect you a little, because if someone makes some kind of accusation against you or says that you said something or you did something and you're like, hey, no, I didn't do that. You can just be like, all right, like, review the footage, listen back to the recording. You can hear what was said. So actually, I think it's, I'm not a big fan of like cameras everywhere, surveying people right. everywhere. But if you're talking about a situation with kids and, you know, an adult figure, whether it's a classroom or a nursery or something like that, then I think the argument for it is pretty solid. I think it's pretty solid.
Yeah. And I mean, public school teachers are public servants the same way that police officers are. And if police officers have cameras, then I can understand the argument for it. I think personally, I don't see too much problem with it. I know that some people at FIRE do. And it's mostly, I think, in the realm of protecting the privacy of the students. So probably it would come down to, you know, what would you be doing with this film? Like, it might chill speech because kids are afraid their parents will see it. So they won't be honest and open about what they're saying in school. So I can understand that argument. And then it becomes a question of, you know, well, does this outweigh that?
I mean, I believe ultimately it's, you know, the parents really... I mean, some people have this weird notion of like the state owns your children.
Right.
Right. But right. I think very much that the buck stops with the parents. And, you know, it shouldn't be, if I have a child, I'm not a parent yet, but I'm kind of working this through in my head because I haven't thought about it that much in detail myself. But I'm thinking, okay, if I've got a son or a daughter who's going to school and there's some issue or whatever, why would a teacher not want me to see or hear what my child is learning, right? That in itself raises a concern as to, okay, sure, well, what are you trying to hide from me, right?
Sure,
I mean, I remember going to school. I mean, if all my school things were recorded, I mean, that wouldn't have been anything particularly for the most part, which would have been, you know, it would have all been fairly mundane. Cool, you're in math class, you're in English class, you're reading a book, you're doing some tests or whatever it is. But I think in terms of the conduct, yeah, I think I would. I don't know why, if someone didn't want me to be able to see or hear it, I would think that something is up.
Then you'd really want it, right?
yeah. Exactly. I think that, wait, yep. What's going on? Why are you trying to hide? Why are you trying to hide this from me? I think it's a shame that it's I think it's a big shame that it's even potentially considered necessary or something that needs to be considered. You know, I think the ideal thing would just be that, cool, you just have great teachers and they're decent people and they're honest and they're honorable and they're not trying to manipulate and indoctrinate your children in any kind of bad or perverse way. But given what we know is already out there and has been for decades, I'm not a... And I think as long as it's limited in that scope, I think as someone who's very libertarian minded, I guess there's always the concern of, like, you know, concept creep or the slippery slope of ending up in some crazy surveillance society where, right, like that's a general concern always. But again, something limited to if we're talking about public, if we're talking about public schools, we're talking about, you know, people's tax money is going to this. These people are public servants. They work for the state. Then I think that's a different realm to even a private school. Perhaps in a private school, that's a different matter. But in a public school, I think there should be some visibility of that. And it could also be done in a way where it's not where it can't be sort of misused, right? You're filming all the students and there's privacy concerns or whatever. It could just be, you know. I don't know. You could even blur people's faces, or you know, whatever the case may be. It could be a camera that's primarily on the teacher, and you're not even seeing the students. Just like you kind of have these CCTV cameras and things, or even audio. It could even just be audio, right?
Yeah, and
maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't even need to be video. It could just be audio, just hearing what's going on. Maybe.
Now I'm wondering how many cameras already are in classrooms. That would be an interesting study, or if that data is even out there. I mean, I think ultimately it'll be determined school board by school board, and which is how it's supposed to be in public education. It's democratically decided, right? You know, vote for the people who represent you, and you have a say, and majority wins. But there is this really annoying attitude that a lot of teachers have about my classroom, in my classroom, my this, my that, and I'm like, you know. It's not your classroom. That classroom belongs to the community. They're the ones who pay for it. Their children are in your classroom. So you can get over this idea that it's yours. And, you know, one of the examples of deceit was Philadelphia. We're based in Philly. And a teacher who asked publicly on a message board that, you know, they talk about it as doing the work. And in this case, I think he was talking about gender work, right? We're doing the work, which is activism, right? Yeah. And he says, how many of you, when you're doing the work, have adopted the strategy of what happens here stays here? Which is, you know, and I joke in the book, I'm like, what is this, Las Vegas? I mean, how creepy is that? And that's that deception and the lack of transparency, which is exactly why these parents are showing up so angry. I mean, there has been so much good faith between home and school that has been squandered in the space of the last 18 months. You know, because we all have, I think, most of us have this rosy conception of schools. And, you know, you take your little kindergartner there, and that's the first time you hand them off to another adult, and you have to trust that that person will not try to undermine you or turn your child against you. They're doing that in the schools too. You know, it's like, you don't know this, but your parents are really bad people and they're upholding a system of oppression and, you know, systemic discrimination, and, you know, you're here to stop it and you're here to fix it. And so they're putting wedges between races, between the generations, between parent and child. And, you know, when you take your kids to school, it's probably the first time that you've handed them off. Maybe you have to a babysitter, but you're trusting perhaps a stranger. And the only thing that gives them credibility is the fact that they represent the school, you know, that they have this credential, they're a teacher. And you have to trust that they're not going to work to undermine you or work to turn, you know, God forbid, your child against you, which I'm hearing that they're telling kids that, you know, your parents are from a generation that is discriminatory and they uphold a system of patriarchy or cis, hetero, this or whatever it is, and all these other isms, and but we're better than that, and we're going to build a new world, and you know, they're like colluding with your kids against you in some of these systems, and so the trust that we've always presumed between school and home has so much damage in the last 18 months has happened, and it's going to take a very long time to restore that trust. And you know, it begins with transparency, owning up when mistakes have been made, and then resolving to work together to do it. But when you hear, you know, the big news this past week has been this NSBA letter. Have you heard about this? Where the National
School
Board?
No, I'm not familiar.
Oh my goodness! The National School Boards Association sent a letter to the White House asking for interventions because of the parents showing up at school board meetings, and they likened them to domestic terrorists.
Oh yes, okay, yeah. Yes.
And then the DOJ responded and said that they will coordinate efforts, which is, you know, the DOJ letter memo was not as overwrought as the NSBA letter, but this is the National School Board Association that, you know, these are the people that we take our problems to, and they're calling parents domestic terrorists. I mean, mm-hmm. talk about hostility. I mean, I think that we've seen rising disrespect for parents that has now risen to outright contempt. Mm-hmm. And this is not a path forward. That has to be corrected.
Yeah. Honestly, as a growing up, I never really considered, I often think about, okay, what am I going to do when I have children in the future? Right. And homeschooling, I mean, when I was growing up, I mean, I knew a couple homeschool right. people, but like, I mean, I went to a good school and everything. I went to good schools. So lots of this stuff wasn't really a concern, but the way I see things going now, I'm like, man, maybe I'm going to end up homeschooling my future kids, or yep. putting them in something different, because the trajectory and the trend on this is concerning. And to use the activist's own language, you know, perhaps it needs to be dismantled. Right? Yeah. Perhaps the yeah. institution is so corrupt that it actually just needs to be, you know, taken apart and let the free market do it.
You could deconstruct it.
Yeah, exactly. Let the free market do its job. Let parents step up and work out the best way to do things. And ultimately, I also think that, I mean, I've had problems with the education system for quite a while. And I think that it's one of the few sectors or industries which hasn't really been properly disrupted yet.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm in the world of music and entertainment. Music has been disrupted, right? Things have gone from physical to digital. Yeah. You had the advent of downloads and streaming. Photography disrupted, right? People aren't going and you know, using the film cameras now and going and getting. I mean, so many industries have been disrupted. Yeah. Education seems to really be lagging behind, in that it hasn't really evolved much over the past, I don't know, century.
It's still kind of what you're still talking
right?
about.
Yeah, it's still based on this model that all these kids are going to go and work in a factory or something, and you know, start at this time, end at this time, have bells in between, all sit down in this room with this. I mean, yep. I don't know exactly what the way forward is, but I think that I feel the same about university as well. I think university also massively needs to be disrupted, because the value for money is terrible. The opportunity cost for most degrees has never been worse than it is now, and it needs disruption. And I've said before that education is not expensive. You know, higher education even is not expensive. University is expensive. Education is cheap. University is expensive. And people conflate those two things, that, you know, university and education are identical, and they're not. And so I think that once the credentialing can be worked out, because I still think the greatest value, particularly from university, is getting the piece of paper, right? You know, I went to Oxford University, so I've got a piece of paper saying I went to Oxford University, right. And that's recognized globally as like, wow, this guy must be smart. He must be brilliant. But if you could get that credential from another way, in a way that it's sort of recognized and respected, and I guess you'll never be able to, you know, perhaps beat something that's existed for many, many centuries in terms of name brand recognition, But I think that with the shift of online learning and other new channels that are going to be popping up, I think we're going to come to a time, and it's already slowly happening. I know a lot of young people who own companies, and they don't care what degree you have. They care what if you can do the job, right? If I'm going to hire someone, your degree is totally irrelevant to me. In fact, there are certain degrees which will make me less likely to that would make me less likely to hire you. You know, if you majored in I don't know, if you majored in women's studies with a side order of queer theory, then that's going to raise some red flags for me. But yeah, I think with every challenge comes opportunity, and I think that as concerning as a lot of this stuff is, and as concerning of a lot of the things going on in the world are, I think it's creating an opportunity for bright people and entrepreneurs and people with values and principles to step up to the plate and create something new and better.
It's all out in the open now. I mean, I've been sort of, you know, shouting into the wilderness for, you know, at least a decade on this. And now there people are shouting too. And I am not the only, you know, I was never the only one aware of this, but most people are aware of this now. And that's a very good thing. So I think that probably is a positive note, is that awareness, you know, recognizing there's a problem is the first step to fixing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And Bonnie, where can people check out your book, and where can they find you online?
Yeah, well, I am at Bonnie Kerrigan on Twitter, and you can find the book, on Amazon, Undoctrinate. And I do have a website too, undoctrinate.org.
Amazing. Bonnie Snyder, thank you for coming on the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. It's been amazing talking to you.
Same here. What a pleasure. Thank you.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.